Welcome to the first Cranfield Executive Development Podcast, where we interview the people that make Cranfield tick. I'm here today with Professor Kevin Morrell. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. This whole idea and concept came from us a few weeks ago, went for a coffee, and I just found the conversation so interesting. And it could have gone on for ages. And we went down many different avenues.
Yes,
we'll discuss some of those today.
Lots of pathways and forks in our conversation.
We did. And I was just trying to get you on board to do to work on Thrive, our new programme, and see if you wanted to be part of that. But I think it's turned into lots more opportunities.
Yeah, it's mushroomed. But yeah, I'm keen on Thrive, obviously.
So, Kevin, to start off, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, sure. So, my name's Kevin Morrell. I'm the Rowlands Chair in Transformational Strategy here at Cranfield. That's an endowed chair, which means the money comes from an individual. Simon Rowlands, who's an MBA alumnus, he's also on the University Council, co-founded a very successful private equity firm, Cinven, and he's interested in how established firms with boards of directors can make transformational change, large-scale change. And the wider sort of business context for that is the advent of disruptive technologies like 3D printing, AI, VR, and so on, which are sort of changing business models and changing the competitive landscape.
Wow. So could you tell us a little bit about how you got here, how you ended up in this position, talking about some huge topics?
Yeah, so I guess by background, I am quite interdisciplinary. So my first degree was in philosophy. After that, I worked for a while in industry. Then I did a master's in human resource development, which led to me getting funded to do a PhD in organizational behavior. So for my PhD, I looked at the decision process nurses go through before they quit jobs. So I was interested in the difference between a rational decision-making account and an account. If you actually talk to people why they quit, you get a very different story after the event versus how it's you know, how they might predict it. Following that, I did a couple of research type posts, King's College London and also Warwick Business School. And then I became interested in the kind of interface between organizational behavior and strategy. So my interest in strategy are really on the people side. But I still bring with me that interest and that love of philosophy. So I'm still interested in things like ethics and, you know, well, virtue ethics, which is partly where my roots of my interest in narrative and stories lies.
And that's really how we first came together to speak about this idea of storytelling, and which is a huge subject. It's a very in vogue subject at the moment. However, your take on it, I think, is particularly unique and interesting. Could you just bring that to life for us?
So a lot of people do talk about that. You know, you even hear, if you watch a football match, the commentators at halftime will say something like that, you know, West Ham really need to change the narrative or something like that. It's kind of a buzzword. Where I've been interested in it is not so much looking at the content of stories, what's been relayed, but looking at how stories are put together. And that goes back to some of my interest in literary criticism and the work of a guy called Viktor Shklovsky, who was very influential in the beginning of the 20th century, wrote an essay in 1917 called Art as Technique. And his whole thing was, again, it wasn't really about the content of the art, but it was how it was put together. And there's one idea in particular from his work that's become very influential in literary criticism, but also in other fields. And that is the idea of, well, just different terms for it, defamiliarization or estrangement. So what makes a story very powerful or compelling, or what makes a work of art compelling, is it makes you look at the world in a new way. It puts a kind of twist or a spin on something. It makes it unfamiliar. So talking about this essay that he wrote, Art as Technique, in his essay, he says that the purpose of art is to make objects unfamiliar. And he says that the central task is to make the stone stony, is what he says. So you take a very mundane object, but what the artist does is he makes you recover the mystery and awe that you might have had when you saw that object for the very first time. So he picks the most mundane object you can think of, a stone, and says that great artists make the stone stony. And in a way, if you look at art across different cultures, often it is about natural phenomena, about rivers, waterfalls, flowers, clouds, or whatever. So I'm interested in how you do that with other kinds of narrative. How do you make the stone stony? How do you make people think about their organization in a different way? How do they think about their customers in a different way, or their product, or the marketplace, or whatever?
I find that absolutely fascinating, the idea of the mundane, but looking past that. And when you think about the first thing that came to my head is when you thought about making the mundane really interesting was the sitcom The Office.
Okay, yeah.
In particularly the British version, which this idea of this really mundane, obviously you've got the characters within that mundane paper merchants, and how that narrative builds, and it became so gripping and intense and interesting and uncomfortable to watch through much of it. And but that really is that idea that it's something that it doesn't have to be a setting, an environment that is all amazing. It can be something that is just completely
everyday.
Yeah.
I think that's right. And I think that, I mean, we were discussing this in relation to the Thrive course. I mean, I think that sometimes just giving attention to an object or a sensation or an experience is in itself extraordinarily powerful and rewarding. I remember, I'd not even thought about this for years, but you know, there's something called the raisin test, where basically you get a raisin, just one, and you chew it for, you know, a minute and actually concentrate on the sensation of it. And it's a strange experience because you might shovel them down by the handful, but if you really focus on one, you know, it's a very different experience. But I think just giving attention to something is really key. And when you think about that in relation to executives, they don't have that time, you know, they don't have the bandwidth, I suppose, use a bit of a cliche, to give attention to things. There's a kind of continual flow of information and, you know, emerging chaos or whatever, but there isn't the time to concentrate and, you know, I guess be mindful of
be
things.
Absolutely present. I think sometimes in the executive development space, sometimes when we do our best work, it's around giving people the time to be really present in their leadership and what they're doing. And one of the things actually for Thrive that we are really want to work with people in, and we've seen lots of techniques that can really help them, is to start to filter out the mini dramas and actually the stories and the things that are happening that actually don't add any value if it's given attention to it. And starting to absolutely focus on the things that add value. And I think that can be quite liberating for people when they realise that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, going back to this making the stone stony, it's part of recovering a sense of mystery and awe and attention, because, you know, you can kind of get burned out or too wrapped up in a treadmill or a hamster wheel. And so, I mean, recharging batteries is much too simplistic an expression, really, but I think recovering that mystery about the everyday, or looking at things in a new way, thinking about one's own identity, you know, through the lens of stories or whatever, is potentially very valuable for people. And, you know, part of that is about being in a different space, around different people. So yeah, attention is our currency, isn't it? If you think about the way that, you know, the way that social media works is by trying to rob us of our attention for little, you know, bits of, you know, scrolling or clicking. It's often about attention being like the currency, because eyeballs are paid for in terms of advertising.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that time. It's those habits that many of us have formed that take our attention. One of the things that I've become really aware of it, and I make sure that I very rarely have these distractions, but I wouldn't have a smartwatch, for example, because you get people that just, you know, it could be in the middle of something really important meeting, and then suddenly the watch is buzzing and they're looking at it, or your phone's going off, and it takes the attention away. And we know emergencies happen and things happen, but generally those things are just stealing attention from people. There's a book about that I love called Stolen Focus by Johan Harim, and it's just absolutely wonderful in starting to think about, actually, as we live in a society that is either we're producing or we're consuming. But in most of that time that we're not really that present in it, because we're thinking about the past to make decisions now, or we're thinking about what's happening in the future.
Yeah.
And I find that compelling. And I love that idea around this, when you talk about, when I've heard you talk about storytelling in terms of being able to get communication across and get messages across, and thinking about them being, that communication being really present and absorbing people into the moment. And you've done some research around the use of fairy tales and narratives that are close to fairy tales.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're the simplest story structure that we're all familiar with. And so I mentioned Viktor Shklovsky. So he was a part of the school called Russian Formalism. They're obviously called Russian because they were in Russia. But formalism was about this idea that you don't look at the content of something, you look at how it's put together, the form of something. And the sort of my favorite work from that era was, right towards the end of that era, was by this guy called Vladimir Prop, great name. And in 1929, he wrote something called The Morphology of the Folktale. My morphology meant the form. He was talking about the general structure of a folktale. And what he showed was there'd been lots of people who'd been interested in how folktales or fairy tales could be categorized. So you might have some tales that were about animals, some that were about everyday objects, some that were about magical tales, some that involved a hero, fool, some that involved three brothers or something. And lots of people have tried to categorize these into different groups, but nobody could quite make those categories fit because they kind of overlapped and they bled into one another a little bit. But what Prop did was he came up with this incredible solution where he said, basically, it's not about the content of the tale. It's not about whether it's got a hero, fool in it, or three brothers or whatever. It's about the characters and the functions that they perform. What do they do in terms of moving the story forward, moving the plot forward? So let me give a very simple example. In a fairy tale, you have a beginning, which would be something like the protagonist is left on their own. Before that, they're given a command, what Prop calls an interdiction. And a command would be something like, don't go into the forest, or look after your brother, or don't talk to strangers. And then the very first thing that happens in the fairy tale is that's broken. It's like a law of physics. Even though we're talking about a cultural phenomenon, there's a kind of inevitability that will happen. It's an axiomatic rule, you know. And if you broaden out that logic, what Prop did was he showed that there were 31 functions, which if you arrange the story in chronological order, they happen in sequence. So they don't all happen in every single tale, but across the folk tales as a whole, there are these 31 steps that happen in sequence. You know, so one of the, about halfway through is one called the hero is transferred or delivered to the whereabouts of an object of search, right? So across different tales, that could be somebody is riding on a magic carpet or going on the back of a giant fish crossing water, or a hedgehog might be going underground, or someone might be following bloody footprints or whatever. All these things that give, you know, tales their colour. A bear might be carrying them on their back in a big basket or something. And Prop's genius is saying that all these things boil down to that one function. And to make the story powerful and effective, you have to have this function appear at a certain time in the story to give it that logical flow. Logical is maybe the wrong way to describe what happens in a fairy tale, but to make it compelling, you know, to make it seem unfamiliar, to make it seem strange. And so what I'm interested in is, can we do the same thing with, if you like, strategy stories? Can you look at characters in the strategy story that might be your competitors, your employees, your way of working, your new product, the marketplace, or whatever? And can you try and create stories that show how they interact in very sharply definable and predictable ways? So there is a kind of almost a seeming inevitability to what happens in the strategy story. So getting lessons from the fairy tales and applying it to the real world. And I've used that approach in in a number of settings, you know, do the recipes we learn as children still apply to how we make sense of the world as adults?
That's really interesting, and I'm really pleased you said that, because I was thinking about where does this storytelling culture that we live in, where does it come from?
Mm.
Where's it originated from? Because it seems to me that it almost is what sets humans apart in how we tell stories and how we make sense of the world through those stories, whether it's something that is an action or a movement, or it is a whole narrative that is told.
Yeah, so I mean, I think stories are sense-making currency. They're the way that we understand the world. You know, if you look, there's been research in the last sort of 10 years or so that shows that if you look at the stories told by First Nations of Australia, they are able to locate the island, locate the geographical whereabouts of islands that have been submerged as long as 10 or 12,000 years ago. And that's simply through an oral tradition of storytelling, because there's not a written culture. So I would say that, you know, there's that cultural software, but the way that I describe it is you don't just have the cultural software, it's actually biological hardware as well. So there was a really interesting study in a medical journal, actually, which showed that if you tell people, different people in different places at different times, if you read to them or play an extract of the same story, you can see that their heartbeats would actually synchronize. So you have them hooked up to an electrocardiogram. And if you look at the trace, doing it to different people, following a story, the heartbeats actually overlap.
You know? You can just imagine that, can't you? If you're sitting down watching a horror film or a thriller romance and the emotions that you go through, even though you know that that is not real
that's really interesting that you mentioned that. So I would think absolutely that is the case. One of the things they did in this study was they did it with an extract, 15-minute extract from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne. And they found these heartbeats synchronizing. And then when they shuffled it up, this 15-minute extract, when they shuffled it up into one-minute segments and they put them in a different order, they found that the heartbeats didn't synchronize. There wasn't that kind of sense, that narrative sense. But what interests me about what you mentioned about, obviously, yeah, horror movie, everybody's going to jump when they first see Jaws come out of the water at the boat or whatever. But what was really fascinating about this study is that they also did it with instructional videos from YouTube in physics. So they took the transcripts from those, very, very factual and you might think quite boring and mundane stuff, and they got the same results. So they got the heartbeat synchronizing. So there's something about the narrative format, whether we're relaying it in terms of like a fairy tale, you know, an exciting thing about a hedgehog following bloody footprints or whatever it is, that applies equally when we're talking about what, you know, if you go into a library, what would be in the facts section versus what would be in the fiction section.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. And I was thinking about the facts and the fiction, they kind of converge, can't they?
Definitely.
Because if we think, and you said like you'd studied philosophy earlier on in your career, and if we think about philosophy as a basis, that is a basis of stories, whether things are true, whether things are useful, whether they're not useful. I suppose that is just a base of stories that we help us live our lives or frame the world.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually wrote I would not recommend this if you are being in a business school academic, but I actually wrote a book on Aristotle. So he was a philosopher that I found very, very interesting. And he wrote a book called The Poetics, which is an account of artistic forms, and it's a scientific analysis of it. So the philosophy bit is to do with aesthetics, the philosophy, science of beauty, you might say, or the philosophy of art. And what he does with in the Poetics is he explains why you have why heroes have to have certain characteristics, or heroines. I mean, at the time it would be heroes, right? Gendered in ancient Greece. But he says, for example, that you can't have a hero who is too virtuous, because if they're too virtuous, the audience doesn't connect with them, right? Because, you know, okay, they're just here. They're kind of boring in a way. So if you look at every cop movie, the cop always has these very visible character flaws, right? They smoke, or they are a bad father, or they have, you know, problem with alcohol or something like that, right? And the reason that they have those flaws is actually explained in the poetics. So the scientific analysis that he put forward, you know, over 2,000 years ago is still relevant, you know, to understanding, you know, even the most contemporary and most recent fiction that we have, yeah.
So one of the things you're coming to do within Thrive is coming to talk about stories and the power of stories.
Yeah.
And starting to help the participants with looking at the story they tell themselves,
yeah,
about themselves, and yeah, they tell others about themselves.
Yeah.
And why is that important?
I mean, I think one of the things that is helpful, I guess, is to think about things like coherence and integrity. Not in a preachy way, but life is much simpler if the stories you tell yourself about yourself and the stories you tell others about yourself are the same, I think, you know, or at least if there's, you know, coherence across them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're, you know, if you're riven by insecurities, or you feel, you know, you don't really believe what you're doing, let's say, then it just makes life a lot more complicated.
And I don't think you're saying that obviously in different situations you'll act differently, but it's about those core values, I think you're saying.
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, going back to Aristotle, my thing about virtue ethics, right? So virtue is the idea, it's the simplest way of talking about virtue is to say living the good life, right? So someone is virtuous if they are pursuing that course of, you know, course of action. What I really like about virtue ethics, unlike other ethical systems, is it places a lot of emphasis on the moral agent and their character, how it unfolds and develops over time. Most of what we do when we think about ethics or law or duty in the West, when it comes to, let's say, how markets are run, how organizations should be run or whatever, most of that is cross-sectional. It's like, are you following a principle, or if you take this decision, will it lead to optimal outcomes? But virtue perspective is very different. It's not looking at acts, it's looking at agents. And part of that unfolding over time, that developing over time, is to do with a story. So virtue ethics, I see it as a narrative ethic. You know, it's about how things unfold over time. Because to live the good life, you only really know if you've lived a good life at the end of it.
Yes, of course.
So, yeah, I mean, a bleaker way of putting this, in Oedipus, there's a phrase, call no man happy until he is dead, because you don't know what's, you know, what's around the corner.
And that comes back to the magic. Not knowing what's around the corner is the magic of life and the awe of life.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, I suppose that it's all, you could also link it back to the theme of attention, because, like, again, talking about virtue ethics, I've been banging on about this for ages, but talking again about virtue ethics, what's really helpful in Aristotle's account of this is the idea of habits. If you think about the conscious mind, this is one of the weird things about neuroscience, I think, is that every few months there's this breakthrough that tells us what Aristotle told us 2,000 years ago about how we think and deliberate and the connection between emotion and reason and rational choice and all that. But I mean, I think understanding habits is so important, because we delegate so much of our life to that without necessarily thinking about it. You know, the world's too complicated to process and evaluate every decision. So, you know, 90-95% of what we're doing is habitual and automatic and unconscious. We don't reflect on it. So, you know, part of cultivating attention is thinking about the habits that you have. You know, you mentioned before we were on, before we were talking, that the, you know, you were trying to switch your phone off at certain times, you know, have almost like a detox or whatever. And that's an incredibly powerful habit if you can incorporate that into your daily life, you know, because that is preserving attention. You know, but focusing on habits, thinking about attention, you know, it's all wrapped up in this storytelling perspective.
And I think that's why it's so fascinating, your work, because it bridges so many things that we do here at Cranfield, because it bridges it and it gives it a foundation. And the attention thing is absolutely huge, because I'm always of the case, like, how can we expect, you know, the world, there are many huge issues, wicked problems in the world, and how can we expect humans to be able to solve them if they're distracted? If they're distracted by WhatsApp, if they're distracted by news, which is a whole series of dramas, how can we put attention on those problems? And they could be huge problems to the world, but they could also be small problems within a family unit or a day at work and things that are going on.
Absolutely. I mean, the way that you habitually talk to people is extraordinarily important in terms of how your career is going to unfold and how your personal life will be and so on.
One of the things that I've used with some people before, and we'll be using this in Thrive actually, is using the Ikigai concept and helping people start to think about where they give the most value and where they get the most happiness from that. And we're not talking about pleasure, we're talking about happiness.
Yes.
And I find that a really very powerful tool.
Yeah.
And which is, again, it's all bedded in a story that we tell ourselves, and it's just one that is many people find quite useful.
So the thing about Ikigai, which I find interesting, and you mentioned earlier happiness versus pleasure. And again, I'm going to talk about, you know, Aristotle. So what he says about happiness is really, really insightful, I think. He says happiness, he doesn't use that term exactly, is an activity. It's an activity of the soul in accordance with virtue. So what he means by that is to be happy is not a state of being like pleasure is. It's about an unfolding of character. It's about aiming for something. It's a verb. It's a doing. And I think that that's a much more satisfactory way of understanding happiness than thinking about it in terms of pleasure or satisfaction, because those are temporary states.
Yeah.
You know, if someone in life is looking forward to things and they feel that they're aiming for something that is valuable, maybe something that they feel is making the world better, something that's improving them, you know, I think that's a much better recipe for understanding happiness than it being about things like having possessions, obviously, or being in a certain state of mind, or, you know, having achieved something. It's more about the ongoing pursuit and activity of the soul in accordance with virtue.
Yeah, absolutely. And it takes us, I think it just keeps coming back to this thing about distractions. And, you know, that not that there's anything wrong with pleasure whatsoever, but what we often find is, and some of the programs that I look after when we talk to executives, you know, they're in powerful roles, they have a lot of responsibility. But when we start looking at sessions around energy and well-being, we see lots of people have the same habits of chasing moments of pleasure as distractions, as things to look forward to, whatever they might be. That might be a small thing in eating something that isn't that useful to their body.
Yeah.
Or it could be buying a possession that they've always wanted. And some of those people, not all of them, sometimes will say, do you know what? But those things, then I want more. Then I want more. And I think that plays into our whole human existence is around that. And happiness is at a completely different level.
Definitely. And I love that you mentioned the body, because people don't talk about that. You know, I'm certainly at other institutions, other universities I've been at, the body is almost seen as something that is secondary. You know, it's the vehicle for getting your brain around from one lecture theatre to another or whatever. But I mean, I think attention to things that are somatic, you know, to do with the body, is kind of crucial. Again, it's about habits, because that's where the unconscious resides, in a sense. It's in one's body. And thinking about that in terms of development and, you know, whether, because, I mean, I know your background in nutrition, for instance, you know, and sports science. I mean, I think those things are completely overlooked when it comes to education, which is crazy, because, you know, they're foundational. You know, how one, the fuel you're giving yourself, the care and the love, if you like, that you're showing yourself through exercise, through discipline, is crucial, really.
Yeah, it is. And it comes back to this thing about how do we, you know, we've done decades, you could say centuries of self-development that's been very much cognitive, has been very much about learning new things, being able to understand the world and things. But I feel that there is now a time to change that and start looking at human beings in a way that how do we actually create the human advantage? Through some of the work we do, through our Thrive program, we're looking at, you know, technology can do so many wonderful things now. So how do we get humans in a place that they can work alongside technology and use their creativity, their human advantage to do amazing things?
Yeah.
And I think that is really exciting. And it's not always the most exciting narrative for the press around AI and things like that. But actually, for me, that is the exciting narrative when you can get creative people who give amazing energy into the world and put them alongside technologies that, you know, that can fundamentally change the paradigm of the world that we live in at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, so many things firing off after what you were saying there. I mean, you mentioned AI just at the time I was thinking about. That's kind of lurking in the background, isn't it, of what we're saying when we talk about the human advantage and the body and things like that and ethics or whatever. We're doing stuff at Cranfield in other faculties, you know, in terms of intelligent manufacturing and the interface between people and machines and, you know, drone technology and all those kinds of things. I think what is quintessentially human is things to do with one's body and one's mind being in sync and, you know, thinking about how that is an unfolding story and how it makes sense in relation to the context that you're in, the environment that you shape, but are also shaped by. Investing in one's development and learning has always been the smart thing to do. But it feels even more the case now that, you know, with the advent of AI, with it encroaching upon so many areas of what it is to be human, reconnecting with the human is really important endeavor, I think.
Yeah. The possibilities it creates are huge.
Yeah.
So tell us about, you're going to come work on Thrive with us, and it feels a bit different from what you've done before, coming in and doing that. Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to as part of that journey and this new project?
I mean, I really like working here because, you know, compared to some institutions I've worked at, I get to work with quite small groups. And I think I'm really interested in getting to know people a little more intimately, I guess, than in terms of, you know, delivering a lecture to somebody or having a seminar or whatever. Because, you know, I mentioned, you know, my master's, which was quite a while ago now, in human resource development. I've always been interested in, you know, learning and growth and, you know, it's still a part of my everyday sort of life, you know, trying to pursue those things. So I think the chance to get to know a small group and watch what I think will probably be quite a profound transformational experience based on similar courses that we've run here before. So I think that's really exciting. You know, if you can get the sense that you're having an impact on someone and they're growing and learning and developing, becoming more of who they can be, you know, flourishing, if you like to use an Aristotelian term, flourishing, then that can be really rewarding, really exciting.
Yeah, and I'm sure for us as the delivery team, we will go on a journey with the participants at the same time. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Mm.
For those listening, we won't go on for ages because that would be a bit unfair for them. But it's been great, and I really look forward to working with you on Thrive.
Me too.